Now voters went to the polls in two states, West Virginia and Nebraska, yesterday to throw their support behind the remaining candidates for president.
It was a big sweep for the presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump, who won in West Virginia and at the GOP primary in Nebraska.
And Bernie Sanders riding high after his last couple of wins.
Last week we won a really great victory in Indiana. And tonight, it appears that we've won a big, big victory in West Virginia.
There was also a Democratic vote in Nebraska where Hillary Clinton won, but didn't really get to take much away from that.
And there's some drama in the GOP following comments made by Speaker Paul Ryan and former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin.
Joining us now to talk about national politics is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Let's visit West Virginia first. Trump wins. No surprise. Nobody's running against him. It's a done deal now. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, this was going to be one of Trump's best states, even if he had competition that was still actually running. He has done very well in the states along the Appalachian Mountains, the counties in Pennsylvania, the counties in Ohio. So the idea that he was able to win there was no big surprise. But he got all of the delegates coming out of that state, and his march towards 1,237 delegates remains unimpeded, and he shall be the nominee unless something happens in this season, who the heck knows, by June 7th.
And we see Trump sort of pivoting at this point and training his firepower on Hillary Clinton. Here he is taking her on recently.
And how about Hillary Clinton? I was watching her 3 or 4 weeks ago. See, I'm going to put the miners back to work, and she said, I'm going to put the miners and the mines out of business. And then she comes over and she tried to explain her statement. That's a tough one to explain, wouldn't you say?
So far we've got that exchange about the miners, Trump targeting Clinton on that. What is your sense, Harry, of what to expect from that potential, possible, in all likelihood, Trump-Clinton matchup that we're going to see?
I think any and everything will be on limits. Nothing will be off limits as far as Trump is concerned. He'll bring up any and everything. I mean, Clinton gave him a wonderful line with the miners. I mean, she screwed up there. She acknowledged she screwed up. But West Virginia is a state that's been trending away from the Democratic Party over the last decade. It's a state that Donald Trump will easily win in the fall, as he did last night. But in terms of attacks, that's just the beginning of it. At least that was an attack that was based on policy. I expect attacks to be based not just on policy, but about personality as well as we head forward. And these are two candidates who are historically disliked. And based upon what we're seeing so far from Trump and how he's going to conduct his campaign and Clinton with hers, I would say the dislike that the voters will have towards these two candidates will rise ever higher as we head into the fall.
Well, looking at those minor comments, West Virginia was a state that was going to be hard for Clinton running against Bernie Sanders, now still in the primary here. That was kind of an own goal in soccer terms. She, an unforced error in baseball terms, she kind of blew it with that, didn't she?
I mean, yeah, she blew it. Not really a huge surprise, you know, but I should say it's not really a huge surprise that she lost there. Maybe she wouldn't have lost by nearly as much, but the Democratic primary has been largely predictable based upon demographics of states, and West Virginia has the third highest non-Hispanic white population in the country. Bernie Sanders has done very well in states that don't have a large percentage of African Americans in them, like West Virginia. Before the primary, we did a demographic model, and we projected that Bernie Sanders was going to win by double digits, just as he did. But still, maybe she lost a delegate or two because of those comments, and certainly it was an unforced error.
And this was a state where she had done better 8 years ago against Barack Obama, a fact which Bernie Sanders was quick to point out.
And this is a state, West Virginia, where Hillary Clinton won by over 40 points against Barack Obama in 2008.
So obviously that was then. This is now, Harry. But what do you make of the fact that she did so much more poorly this time? And does it portend anything for down the road?
Not really. I mean, look, the primary map is kind of the inverse of what it was in 2008 insofar as that Hillary Clinton back then did very well in states or did very well among white voters, while Barack Obama did very well among black voters. This year, Hillary Clinton does very well among black voters, and Bernie Sanders tends to do better among white voters. So in a state that is as white as West Virginia, it shouldn't be too surprising. Remember, this is a state where Barack Obama struggled to win in 2012 when he didn't really have any competition. He lost 40% of the vote to a felon in Keith Judd, who still was on the ballot last night. I mean, Bernie Sanders, even though he won, you know, by 15, 16 points, still only got 51% of the vote, because there was a whole bunch of voters who went into the polls and said, we're not voting for either one of them. So, yeah, Bernie Sanders won, hats off, but this vote wasn't really so much a pro-Bernie Sanders vote. If you look at the exit polls, it was really more of an anti-Hillary Clinton vote.
What did West Virginia do on delegate counts?
18 to 11. So Bernie Sanders picks up 7 delegates. You know, he's still down by about 280. I think the exact number is actually 278, if you're keeping count. Hillary Clinton, this doesn't really change the math. She's still well on her way to the nomination. And I know the Bernie Sanders folks don't like to include superdelegates, but they do at the end of the day vote. And when you include those, her lead is even larger. She is well on her way to being able to clinch the nomination the same day Donald Trump does, that being June 7th.
We're talking to Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst at 538.com, talking about national politics, the latest on the campaign trail.
And we want to hear from you on this. We're going to continue that conversation. What do you think about the election so far? What do you think of Sarah Palin's recent comments about Speaker Paul Ryan and the election in general? It's unusual, to say the least. What do you make of the way it's shaping up? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send your comment to talk@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about yesterday's primaries in West Virginia and Nebraska and some internal strife facing the Republican Party.
And we want to hear from you on this. What did you think of last night's results? If you're a Republican, what would you like to see from your party now that Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us your comments at talk@WPR.org.
Harry Enten is still with us. He's senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. Harry, let's look at the Republican Party. Paul Ryan and others meeting, I think, with Donald Trump tomorrow to try to come to some kind of consensus that allow them to work together in an election, maybe under the Trump presidency. What do you expect from tomorrow?
I don't know. I do not know. This is a very interesting thing. Look, I think that there are a lot of people within the Republican Party who would have preferred that Donald Trump not be the nominee, but he is going to be the nominee. And most of them have recognized that fact and decided that they are a member of the Republican Party, ergo they're going to support the nominee. However, there are holdouts who may be putting their own ideology, which is often intertwined with party, conservatives, of course, being Republicans, they're going to put their ideology above their party. And Paul Ryan is a conservative, and Donald Trump is not that. And I think, you know, Trump also has made some comments about minorities and women and David Duke along the campaign trail that reports indicate that Paul Ryan did not truly appreciate. And so it's going to be very interesting to see if Paul Ryan is going to be able to come and say, you know what, I'm a Republican, I'm going to support the Republican nominee. But there's going to be a lot of pressure on both sides, and Ryan, both from conservatives who hate Trump and conservatives or Republicans who want the base to rally around Trump, as to where Ryan will actually end up going.
And Speaker Ryan spoke recently with some staff from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and they asked him about his previous comments about Donald Trump and the GOP. Here's a little bit of what he said.
I want to help unify our party so that we're at full strength so that we can defeat Hillary Clinton. And I believe between now and July, we will be able to figure out how to unify our party.
If he asked you to step down as chair of the convention, would you?
I'll do whatever he's the nominee. I'll do whatever he wants with respect to the convention. The point I would make is, I just think it's important that all wings of the party come together to get ourselves at full strength.
So Paul Ryan saying he thinks that the party can be unified between now and July. I guess it seems sort of far away, but it also seems like a tall order. How likely do you think it is, Harry, that the party will be unified by the time the convention rolls around?
I mean, if you look at the polls that that have been produced over the last week since Trump got the nomination, he has, in fact, seen some bump in his numbers, and a large part of that are Republican voters who otherwise were not going to vote, who said they weren't going to vote for Trump, coming back to his side. If politicians follow where the voters are, we should see some coalescing around Trump. But I just can't get across how unusual it is that the Speaker of the House doesn't back his party's nominee for president immediately. I mean, this is crazy. I've never seen anything like this. Then again, I've never seen anything like this year before. They could unify, but there's clearly some bruises that need to be covered over, at least, you know, put a Band-Aid on it. But Band-Aids have a way of falling off, so it's going to be very interesting to see, even if they're able to coalesce, whether that holds together, depending on what comments Trump makes on the campaign trail. And knowing Donald Trump, he has an ability to make comments that I wouldn't have even thought that would be possible for a politician to make.
I want to bring in a caller now. We'll go to Emery in Milwaukee. Emery, hi.
Hello, thank you. I think it's commonly accepted or understood that with all the recent polls about November matchups, that pretty consistently Bernie competes better against Trump than Hillary does. And I know there's time, and I know that once it's a head-to-head, attacks will change or what have you. But I don't see Hillary becoming a better competitor against Trump over that time. Maybe numbers go up and down, but I don't see a flip there happening. And then to my question, this week, Steve Inskeep was interviewing Bernie Sanders, asked Bernie if he thought that a Bernie presidency would be better than a Democratic presidency, you know, which is worth fighting for more. I kind of want to flip that rhetorically and ask your guest if he thinks Hillary's side thinks that a Hillary presidency is more important than a Democratic presidency, given Trump.
Emery, I got you, Emery. Thanks for the call. So the first point there, that a lot of people saying Sanders in polls does better against Trump than Clinton.
I mean, it's true. The polls are the polls. Sanders does do better against Trump than Hillary Clinton does. But as your caller hinted at, the question is whether or not that would hold when Bernie Sanders was attacked. I mean, for the most part, Bernie Sanders has not been attacked during this campaign. So, you know, who knows if those numbers would hold up. I think I would say two things. Number one, to that, polls at this point haven't been all that predictive when an incumbent isn't running. But the second kind of point is that we have sort of seen this before. I mean, McCain did better in the polls than George Bush in 2000. In 1984, Gary Hart did better than Walter Mondale in the polls against Ronald Reagan. So there is some precedent for, you know, candidates who haven't been, you know, at the head of their party, who is sort of the second runner, doing better in the general election polls. But we never have a chance to really run those elections and see whether or not those candidates would have actually done better. Maybe Bernie Sanders would do better in the fall. Hillary Clinton's numbers, her favorable ratings are god-awful. So it's possible that Bernie Sanders would do better in the fall. We're just never going to get a real chance to test that hypothesis.
We'll leave it there for now, Harry. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com, looking at the latest on the campaign trail.
Coming up after the news, an investigative reporter looks at the use of drones in targeted killings as part of American anti-terrorist operations.
And you can support conversations like these with your pledge right now to Wisconsin Public Radio. You do it at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Looking for 6 more pledges from you in the next 30 minutes. We can do it together. Thanks for that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. Drones have become a major part of American anti-terrorist efforts. Ramping up under the Obama administration, the U.S. has conducted drone strikes in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, and elsewhere.
The strikes are aimed at suspected terrorists, but our next guest says it hasn't always been clear who's targeted, how drone strikes are approved, or how many civilians have been killed in these attacks.
In a new book drawing from leaked government documents, Jeremy Scahill and his colleagues at The Intercept try to piece together how, when, and where drones are used and what the consequences might be. Jeremy Scahill is an investigative reporter and founding editor of the online news publication The Intercept. His new book is The Assassination Complex Inside the Government's Secret Drone Warfare Program. Jeremy, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, in the book, Jeremy, you write that drones are a tool, not a policy. The policy you write is assassination. Why is it important to say it in those terms up front?
Well, I mean, because there's a lot of attention paid to the technology of drones, and I think that some of that attention, of course, is rightly placed because drones offer a way of attempting to sanitize warfare because you're not risking your own pilots by having them fly over another country. You can have essentially remote control warfare, and President Obama often talks about how drones are more precise than other U.S. weapons platforms. So to just debate the technology is to miss the much bigger issue, which is that we as a society, particularly after 9/11, have watched both the Democrats and Republicans embrace this institution of assassination as an official part of U.S. policy, but they never call it assassination. They call it targeted killing or targeted strikes. And an interesting sort of historical side note to all of this is that the U.S. Congress has refused to ever legislate what constitutes assassination. Most Americans that follow, you know, politics know that there's an executive order that every president from Ford through Obama has upheld that says that the United States does not engage in assassinations. At the same time, Congress has never defined what an assassination is under U.S. law. So basically the point that I'm making there is that when you want to look at this tale of hits around the world that the U.S. has been doing in the name of fighting terrorism, if you just focus on what weapon system they use, then you do so at the expense of a broader discussion about what kind of a nation we want to be and what kind of national security policy we want.
Tell us about the leaked data that provides a lot of the background for you and your colleagues at The Intercept in this new book.
Right. Well, you know, at The Intercept, we, of course, are the leading organization reporting on the revelations from the cache of documents that Edward Snowden provided to my colleagues, Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras. And we do a lot of reporting about the NSA and the CIA. And this particular project that is now in book form in the Assassination Complex is the result of another confidential source, a whistleblower who worked on the drone program and worked with special operations forces in what was called the high-value targeting campaign. And it is the most comprehensive leak of classified documents on the drone program in history. And so what we've done is we've laid out the architecture of assassination, including sensitive slides that show the chain of command leading all the way up to the president. We call it the kill chain, and how these drone strikes are authorized, how these assassination operations are authorized. This is information that has never been in the public domain before, and perhaps one of the most damning revelations from the documents that we obtain is that in some cases, the U.S., 9 of the 10 people that the U.S. kills in these airstrike operations are not the intended target. And in fact, they don't know the identities oftentimes of the people that they're killing. And yet the military and the CIA have a program where they created a mathematical equation that will almost always result in zero for the number of civilians killed, because anyone killed in a drone strike is immediately categorized as an enemy killed in action unless they posthumously are proven to have been an innocent bystander. The only exception would be if it's clearly a woman or a child that's killed in these strikes. So, you know, I think if you look at it as a you know, sort of from the, you know, bird's eye view of the entire thing, this is an extremely significant leak from a whistleblower who was an insider on this program, and it gives lie to a lot of the public proclamations from the Obama administration about the surgical nature of drone operations.
Let's talk about civilian casualties. It sounds like you're saying, based on what you're seeing from these inside documents, we don't know, it's really hard to tell how many civilians have died as a result of these targeted drone strikes.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, the first time that the U.S. used a weaponized drone outside of Afghanistan was in November 2002 in Yemen, and that was authorized by President Bush. And there were 6 people killed, including a U.S. citizen, who we're told was not the intended target of the strike. And then you fast forward to the end of the Bush administration, and drones were just starting to be used widely in Pakistan primarily. Obama comes into office, and he basically, you know, had campaigned on a promise not to engage in what he called dumb wars, like the big, you know, ground invasion of Iraq. And he really embraced this idea that by using technology and using covert special operations action and by using drones, that somehow they could wage a cleaner form of warfare while still taking the fight to the enemy, as they put it. And so when we look at who actually is being killed in these strikes, because oftentimes they're happening in remote locations, unless journalists or human rights workers are able to go to the scene and document who was killed, we're left then to the official proclamations from Washington. And because of the formula they've come up with, where everyone killed is an enemy killed in action until proven otherwise, it's nearly impossible to know how many innocent people or civilians have been killed. It's certainly in the hundreds and quite possibly in the thousands.
We're talking to investigative reporter Jeremy Scahill. He and his colleagues at The Intercept have a new book out. It's The Assassination Complex: Inside the Government's Secret Drone Warfare Program. Jeremy, the argument from supporters of the use of drones might go something like, there are individuals and groups out there who see themselves as being at war with the U.S. and its allies, but they don't fit in with the usual rules of war. They're not in uniform. They're basically exploiting a gray area. Don't we need some kind of gray area response, like targeted killings, targeted drone strikes?
Well, you know, there is not a single person running for president that does not agree with that analysis, including Bernie Sanders. Sanders was asked at the most recent Democratic town hall if he supported the kill list that's maintained by the Obama administration, and he said yes. In the way it's being implemented now, I support the kill list. And Hillary Clinton, of course, is an aggressive supporter of U.S. Militarism, but also, as Secretary of State, was part of what effectively was a paramilitarization of certain aspects of U.S. diplomacy, so that it would feed into the kill system, where drones are the sort of tip of the spear. My response on the questions that you are raising there is that I've been on the ground in Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere, and I think there is no doubt that there are people plotting to conduct terror attacks against the United States. The question I would have is this policy actually making us less safe or more safe? And I think we have created more enemies than we have killed actual terrorists. Now, to the specific point, every nation has a right to defend itself. If the United States is going to come under an imminent and real threat, of course it has a right to defend itself, as any other nation does around the world. But the vast majority of drone strikes have been what I would describe as pre-crime operations, like the Tom Cruise movie, Minority Report, where you basically are profiling people and saying, yeah, we think that they may do something bad in the future, so let's kill them right now. And that's, if that's going to be U.S. policy, then it should be there should be a thorough debate about it. We have embraced a system where we have a parallel justice system, where the president and a few of his allies are essentially serving as prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner, including of American citizens. This isn't to defend the integrity of some of the people that we've killed. Of course, some of them are monstrous individuals, and I would have liked to see them brought to justice. But I don't know of a single drone strike that stopped an imminent attack against the United States. I do know of a lot of drone strikes against people who were not on an active battlefield, had no capacity to kill any Americans, and they were killed in an act of pre-crime without having even been charged with a crime.
A lot of your book looks at how the people are selected as targets and approved as targets for these drone strikes. What did you learn from those leaked documents?
Well, one thing is there's been a lot of talk over the year and reporting that the White House uses what are called baseball cards, BBCs, on terror suspects. And we actually published a document that is the kind of information that's on these so-called baseball cards. And it really is like the kids who were collecting, baseball cards. You there's a picture on the front, you flip it around, and on the back are the stats, the home runs, the batting average, the RBIs, and with these stats. It's who is this person connected to? Are they known to have been a part of a terror plot? What kinds of chatter have we intercepted on their phone calls? And do we believe this person rises to the level of a terrorist that we need to kill? And they have meetings every Tuesday at the White House where the president's deputies essentially sift through these baseball cards and prioritize who should be taken out next. And so that, you know, that's something that, you know, a lot of people have reported around it, and then we published an actual document that shows how that works. The other thing that I think becomes really clear is sort of just the banality of the process that's been created. It's almost like like they think that they've turned assassination into a kind of a science where you can put information into what they call the disposition matrix, and then it spits out an answer on whether someone should live or die. And to me, that was probably the most stunning aspect of this, is how banal the entire process is, and they use corporate language to describe the kinds of individuals that they're taking out and the kinds of operations that they're engaged in.
As you mentioned, some of the first drone strikes under a Republican president increased a lot under a Democratic president. Bipartisan use of drones. Do you see any, at higher levels of government in Congress, any opposition, significant opposition to the use of these drones for, as you say, targeted killings?
Nope, not at all. I mean, it's really kind of incredible. You know, I mean, I cut my teeth as a reporter in the 1990s when Clinton was president, and I covered the war in Yugoslavia and the airstrikes that Clinton was conducting in Iraq under the so-called no-fly zones. And I think part of what we see in our society is that, particularly during election years, a lot of people check their conscience at the door, and they don't want to criticize, you know, their guy or their woman who they happen to be supporting for president. And you know, the reality is that one of President Obama's enduring legacies is the attempt, and I think it was largely successful, to legitimize the type of policy when it comes to so-called counterterrorism that Cheney and Rumsfeld and others ultimately wanted, which is that the U.S. would make clear to everyone around the world that we will kill whomever we want, whenever we want, wherever we want, and that we are not going to engage in any kind of debate about other nations' sovereignty. And for a constitutional law professor who won the Nobel Peace Prize to have gotten the support for what amount to assassinations to skyrocket among self-described liberals really kind of shows you the potency of having a system where there's only two real options on the ballot to vote for when it comes to sustainable parties.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was investigative reporter Jeremy Scahill. His new book is The Assassination Complex: Inside the Government's Secret Drone Warfare Program.